Well, thanks everybody for getting back so promptly since we broke a little bit late for lunch. I appreciate your efforts to get back here timely. As mentioned earlier this morning, COSO has begun an effort to update their framework, integrated framework for internal control. And we're fortunate to have Dave Landsettel and Miles Everson, who are working on the project, Dave being the chairman of COSO. And Lou Ferguson and Keith Wilson are going to lead the discussion from the PCOB's perspective. And Lou, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Marty. Dave Landsettel is here today from the Committee of Sponsoring Organizations of the Treadway Commission, I think much more familiarly known as COSO, to provide an overview of their project to modernize the COSO Internal Control Integrated Framework, first developed in 1992. The purpose of the project is to make the existing framework more relevant to today's complex global business environment so that organizations worldwide can better design, implement, and assess internal control. Auditors are required to consider internal controls as part of all audits, and in integrated audits, auditors must express an opinion on the effectiveness of internal control over financial reporting. For integrated audits, the PCOB standards state that auditors should use the same internal control framework as management does in its assessments. When the auditors or company managements perform an evaluation of internal control over financial reporting, they look, for the most part, to established control frameworks for the criteria to use in making that evaluation. And although the PCOB standards and the SEC rules don't specify a particular control framework to use, in the U.S., the internal control framework that's probably most widely used by public companies and their auditors is the COSO Internal Control Integrated Framework. So an update of that framework is a very welcome development. Now, after Dave's presentation, SAG members will have an opportunity to ask questions and discuss potential implications of these changes in audits. Along with Dave, Miles Everson of PwC, who's on the project team, is here to help answer questions. So I'm going to turn this back over to Keith Wilson and let him introduce Dave and Miles.
Well, I think the introductions have already taken place, so I will just move along. Dave has some slides that are in your materials here today, and he's going to go through, provide an overview of the project, and we're going to then open up for questions, comments to them or to other views of the SAG members on this subject related to this. So, Dave.
Oh, there we go. A little delayed reaction, but thank you, Keith. And Miles and I are delighted to be here today to chat with you. I think the timing's excellent from our standpoint because we're at a stage in our project that not only will we be providing information to you, but we'll be anxious to get comments that'll be input from you that'll be important to us going forward. So we're delighted to be here. Let's see. You did get copies of the slides ahead of time, and I'm not going to have time to go over all the material that's on the slides, but importantly, I want to comment on four areas. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about COSO, just so everybody's on the same page as to our organization. Then I want to talk about the overall objectives, governance, and timetable of our project. Update you a little bit on content changes that are anticipated and structural approaches that we are looking at, and finally, a discussion of potential impact on governance principles, fraud deterrence, and SOX 404. So COSO was formed in 1985 initially to sponsor what is widely known as the Treadway Commission, National Commission on Fraudulent Financial Reporting. A couple things about COSO. It's a voluntary private sector organization with five sponsors, and they've been the same five sponsors since 1985, the American Accounting Association, the AICPA, the FEI, the Institute of Management Accountants, and the Institute of Internal Auditors. The combined membership of those five organizations worldwide is about 500,000, half a million people. So we have good support behind us in terms of our sponsoring organizations. The board members include a representative from each of the sponsoring organizations, as you can see here, Larry Rittenberg, the former chair, and myself. Three of the five organizations, the representative is the CEO of that organization. Those are the last three. And in all cases, they're individuals that command respect and are high enough in the organization that they can speak effectively for the mission and provide guidance. And I'll add, I've been chair for 18 months, and I really think it's an outstanding board. So that's a big plus from my standpoint. And our mission is to provide thought leadership, a think tank, so to speak, dealing with three interrelated subjects, and those are enterprise risk management, ERM, internal control, and fraud deterrence. Having said that, it's important to note that we're not a lobbying group, and we're not a standard-setting group. We look to provide thought leadership on these issues, and others have other responsibilities that deal with standard setting. The products that we've put out over the 20-some years of our existence, 20 years of our existence, include two frameworks, one the internal control framework that we're talking about today and updating, and secondly, an ERM framework that was published in 2004. And this timeline that I've provided shows those documents and also some other materials that we've provided that really extend the thinking that's in those basic frameworks, plus two important research studies that we've sponsored that deal with fraudulent financial reporting. And incidentally, Joe Carcello, who's on the SAG group, is a representative, a co-author of those two fraudulent financial reporting research studies. And most recently, we've published a series of thought papers that we'll continue to deal with, that deal with application of risk management ERM materials in the current environment. So let's look at the project objectives, governance, and timetable. I think Lou articulated the project objectives as well as better than I could. We have a goal to upgrade the framework. We believe that the five underlying components of the framework are more or less timeless and have worked effectively over the years, but the context in the guidance in which those five components exist, it really needs updating. For example, technology, think about 1992, technology didn't include the internet, email, manners of communication are drastically affected, and governance has progressed significantly since that time. So the objective is not to fundamentally change the five components that we think are operating effectively, but to really work on the underlying support for those components that provide a context that's important for the effectiveness of the material. In terms of our own governance, the COSO board has, of course, overall responsibility for this project. We are assisted, importantly, first by PricewaterhouseCoopers, who are making a very significant contribution pro bono in assisting us. Coopers and Lybrants, a predecessor firm of PwC, had a similar role back in the original framework in 1990, 91, and 92, and as part of that agreement, there was a right of first refusal in terms of their any updates, and so Pricewaterhouse was very pleased to accept that and help us out in terms of the project team for this project. I'm very pleased with the project team that Miles has put together and the PricewaterhouseCoopers support. It's going to be very critical to us and very helpful to us. We have an advisory council that's a sounding board to us, and that's very important to the effectiveness of our governance and organization. The advisory council has met two times already, and again, I'm very pleased with the effectiveness of that organization. It works well as a sounding board and has already given us some guidance that's very, very valuable. Our timetable and project plan is outlined in more detail on this schedule than I will go over, but in effect, we've gone through the September to January area where we've done the planning for the project and importantly designed a survey and issued a survey instrument that was important to us getting responses from our stakeholders with respect to that would be relevant to our project, and I'll have a slide on that in a few minutes. The current period, beginning in February and extending through August, is digesting the results of the survey, getting other input, and developing drafts of the material. And so at this point in time, we're in the very early stage of the drafts and also dealing with the structure of the material. And then later on in the year, in the September-December timeframe, we'll go out for public exposure with a 90-day exposure period. And then in the first 6 months of 2012, hope to digest the results of the exposure and develop a final document. Next, I'd like to talk about a little bit about the areas of update in terms of content and also about the document structure. And before I do that, though, I want to interject a little bit about the survey that I mentioned. It was a robust survey that we got 653 responses by the deadline date, which was the end of January. Interestingly, we then concluded to leave the survey open through our website so we can continue on an ongoing basis to get information and use that as one means of getting additional information. But the 653 responses were very pleased. I want to say thorough, robust, thoughtful responses from a broad base of our stakeholders that included large and small companies, not-for-profit organizations. As it says here on the slide, 27% were international, which is important to us. And one overall result, which was consistent with our anecdotal information, was that a large majority of the respondents support updating, but not a major overhaul of the framework. In other words, the approach we're taking where we presume the components are timeless and won't change, but really get the underlying support for those components need to be changed, is consistent with the survey results that we got. So I've listed on this slide and the next slide that you have in your packet a number of areas that we envision will be affected by the update, and I don't want to, in the interest of time, go over all of these areas, but let me real briefly talk about three or four of them. First of all, number one, the increased use of technology and implications from new technology is a very obvious one. If you think back of where we were in 1992 compared to where we are today, not just with the internet and email, et cetera, but now cloud computing, et cetera. I mean, there's lots of IT changes and changes in the environment from that perspective that are important to us. So that's a very obvious area that needs updating. Similarly, number three deals with anti-fraud expectations, which have been enhanced since 1992, and the knowledge of what constitutes good anti-fraud programs has really been given some thoughtful leadership since 1992. So another area that I think is an obvious one that we'll focus on during the revision. Number five, dealing with risk. Obviously, in the last 5 or 10 years, enterprise risk management, risk assessment has become exceedingly visible. And you know, risk assessment is one of our components. So we're anxious to make that more robust in terms of the guidance that we can provide in that area. And interestingly, focusing not just on financial reporting, and I'll mention this because I didn't mention it earlier, but the objectives of the framework extend not just to financial reporting. Financial reporting is relevant under 404, but the objectives of the framework extend to compliance and operational controls as well. And we think we have a real opportunity to make the guidance as it relates to compliance objectives and operational objectives more robust. And so that's an overall interest we have, and it's reflected, I think, in the risk area particularly. And then if you move on to one more that I'll mention, and that's item 9. And again, during the question and answer period, I can certainly be happy to answer questions. Miles and I will on the others. I just don't want to take the time now. But the initial guidance I would describe as principles-based. This guidance that we're developing is also principle-based, with the principles are intended to be outlined more explicitly. And let me, as an aside, in 2006, we put out a publication that applied the original framework in a small business environment, and that publication really articulated some of the framework in a specific principles-based listing of the principles, and we think that's been well accepted, and so we want to, in effect, use that concept in the revision of the guidance. And so in addition to the five components, there will be principles underneath each of those components that will need to presumably be met for a control process to be deemed to be effective. In terms of the document structure, we now believe that there'll be two products at the end of our work, and this is just a recent development that interestingly came out of the last advisory council meeting. At that meeting, we talked quite a bit about a number of issues, but one that created a little tension was one of some individuals on the advisory council being very, very anxious for the document to be more robust, particularly as it relates to compliance and operational objectives, and others on the advisory council wanting to make sure that the path for application of the guidance in a financial reporting arena doesn't become, as one individual said, convoluted. And so there was a little of that tension that we wanted, on the one hand, to expand the document in areas that went beyond what would be relevant at all to 404, for example, and at the same time wanted to preserve the application of the guidance under 404. So what we've concluded is that we'll have two products. One will be an update of the overall framework, which will supersede the 92 document, and another would be a separate document that's the application of the guidance to the financial reporting objective. Now, that financial reporting objective is consistent with 404, but it could be applied certainly beyond what would be required in 404. but it allows us then to have the overall framework be as robust as we think appropriate, and at the same time assure that we have a clear path in the second document for those that only are applying the framework in a financial reporting arena. So that's a conclusion that we more recently formulated, and again, in part after the last advisory committee council meeting. And I might add that after each advisory council meeting, our COSO board meets, and you know, in fact, the very next day, and absorbs the guidance and talks about what the issues are and what kind of guidance we got, and this, you know, was formulated in the board discussion following the council meeting that recently took place. As I alluded to earlier, the document structure will focus on principles explicitly articulated, 20-plus principles in total, extending over the five components. So in other words, for each of the five components, we'll have a specific set of principles that will support those components. And then in the discussion following in the chapter on each of the in each chapter on the five components would be what we'll call attributes, which support the principles. So we kind of have that kind of top-down thought process in terms of the structure of the document. Keith asked me in the discussion before today to provide any comments that we could provide on the impact of the document that the update that we envision as it relates to governance, fraud deterrence, SOX 404, including transition. Let me say it's early in our project, so it's somewhat of a conjecture and hard for us to really, in a definitive way, outline the impact, but we're optimistic that, for example, in terms of governance, that the impact will be a positive one. There's been a lot of development since 1992 that involve the responsibilities of the board, audit committee, compensation committee, and I think for us to recognize that material will provide better guidance to boards and those committees of boards in fulfilling their oversight responsibility. And in terms of understanding, hopefully, what is involved in good guidance as it relates to internal controls. Similarly, in the area of fraud deterrence, I want to say transparency of putting the additional guidance that we believe we can put in the document, the overall framework that deals with the robustness of anti-fraud programs and what we've learned up through today as compared to 1992, and having that be articulated in support of the components in the framework will be helpful in terms of providing a better understanding to what constitutes good anti-fraud programs that are supporting a fraud deterrence objective. We'd very anxious to get your input on those two issues as well. In terms of the impact on 404, again, I think we'll be able to first say that the fundamental components have not changed, and so on an overall basis, the 404 objectives and focus on components will not change. But we do believe that with the articulation of principles, particularly that there'll be more guidance that will be helpful in the carrying out of the implementation of 404 by affected enterprises. So, for example, if we have 20 principles and a conclusion that presumably those principles are relevant to any overall conclusion as to the effectiveness of internal control, then that gives us a little more concrete area for management to follow in terms of determination as to an effective control system and those that attest to it to a determination as to when a control system is effective and when there are shortcomings, weaknesses that need to be focused on. So that concludes my opening comments. Keith, Miles, and I are just anxious not only to get your questions but to get your input because this is a nice time in the project that we need that input. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. We'll open this up for comments and questions and give Miles and Dave a chance to respond. Start with Jim Cox.
As we're all aware, on a Dodd-Frank carved out 60% of the reporting companies out of 404 last summer. And so when that happened, I was sort of curious of who are these people. And so I went out and started reading what literature I could find, studies, et cetera. And I'm not going to summarize that now. It's on a paper that's already out there on the web. And kind of summarize it very briefly and say that the reporting practices for those companies that were carved out is just a mess. And it's that's charitable. More likely it's misleading. And a lot of evidence that the mess and the misleadingness is designed to or facilitates a lot of overreaching conduct. That shouldn't be surprising. I mean, earlier COSO studies showed that most of the abuses with fraudulent financial reporting and SEC enforcement actions are disproportionately, I mean, they're disproportionately smaller issuers. So that said, I wonder if you might not want to consider, as you go down the road and start thinking about the objectives of this, whether you want to have some sort of divide among those your focus of those companies that are subject to 404 and the auditor's attestation to internal controls and those who are now exempt out of 404, and doing that maybe even somewhat more broadly. As you know, that Congress and Dodd-Frank has also invited the SEC to consider whether others should be also exempted, so the number would even go up above 60%. So as to give some thought to that, maybe whatever you think about in terms of internal controls and practices and governance practices could be shaped in part by whether there's a formal attestation process on internal controls or not, okay? So to make that not just an observation, I guess I would ask, is that something you think you would want to consider?
We haven't considered. You know, we want to be careful that, you know, we're not the regulator and we don't want to make value judgments in terms of we'll make a value judgment that internal control is very important to the success of enterprises. But we don't like to. We don't think COSO's objective is to make a value judgment in terms of whether SOX is a good thing or not. I mean, I think it is, but that's not a COSO position. But we hadn't really thought about, or Miles, you may have. I haven't thought about whether or not we can comment on attestation in a way that would support what you're saying.
No, actually, I think you're misunderstanding what I'm saying. I'm saying as you're going forward and you're thinking a little bit about what your objectives are, do those objectives get shaped by the real-world considerations that some firms are not subject to attestation? I'm not asking you to make a value judgment about whether attestation is a good thing or a bad thing. I'm asking you to look at the world as it exists, which is that some firms are carved out of the attestation function and that has an impact.
Okay, good. And it's consistent with the fact that, you know, we do have a separate financial reporting document, so it fits into that arena. Miles, do you have any comments?
Well, the only comment I would add on this is that the core internal control framework is really written, and the update is intending to be for all companies, whether they have an obligation to report externally or have an attestation done on their assertion or not, so that it's relevant to those that don't have an obligation to report, just as it is to those that do.
I'll just point out that the evidence indicates that that the governance matters in terms of whether there is reliable reporting for firms that are small firms. And so to the extent that you mentioned earlier in your roadmap that you're looking at various governance structures and processes, my suggestion would be with those firms that don't have the overlapping attest function by the independent auditor, perhaps you would give some thought to what the governance structure would be to maybe fill in that gap.
Yeah, in effect, what are the implications of not having that attestation requirement? Yeah, no, it's a good thought, and we just really haven't directly focused on that.
Okay, Scott Showalter.
Thank you. I have a question, actually. When you were going through on slide 38, which is the areas to update, you actually skipped the second one, which was incorporate lessons learned from SOX and the cost of benefit considerations. I don't know if you got to that when you were concluding in your possible, but I'd be interested in what did you hear? What were the lessons learned that may have other impact that isn't disclosed in your last couple slides? Were there other things that we should be aware of that came back on the survey?
Do you want me to take that?
Yeah, do you recall in the survey what...
I don't recall the individual specific responses in the survey here. What I would say is that some of the feedback that we got as it related to 404 was, I'll say, creating greater clarity around the role of the control environment versus kind of the view of the level of reliance that's been put around the control activities side was one point. And then secondarily, fair bit of comments around the role of the monitoring component and what constitutes appropriate monitoring for 404 purposes. And so those comments came back both, and the reason I can't distinguish is I'm getting comments directly from individuals as well as from the survey, but those are two common factors that come back to us, because I think there's a general sense that there's too much emphasis at times and reliance on just the control activities component. And so how do the other components take more prominence in evaluating the total system of control?
Joe Carcello.
Dave, a couple of comments. One, let me piggyback on what Jim Cox said. Although there's no longer a auditor involvement for companies with a market cap below $75 million, as Jim knows, I'm sure, there's still a 404A requirement that management has to issue an opinion on internal control without the auditor's involvement. So I think to the extent that you can make the document more specific, particularly reflecting really all of the governance changes that SOX brought into play, which are many, will be helpful. And I think it'll be helpful because right now, the specificity around management's reporting is pretty wide. So I think to the extent that you can tighten it through a more specific framework will probably be helpful. The other thing I would encourage you to do, Dave, and I've probably touched base on with some of this with you in the past, is there's actually quite a bit beyond SOX and beyond the exchange listing standards. There's actually a lot of learning that's taken place as a result of studies that have happened in the last 10 years, and I'll just hit a couple of areas in the interest of time. One is 407. If you go back and you look at the legislative history there, the Congress had originally written the law, not the Congress, the SEC had initially drafted the rule that would have defined an accounting expert pretty narrowly. And then the business community got a little upset, to put it mildly, and they defined an accounting expert so that, let's just say quite broadly, and I think I'm being generous. There's an extremely large literature, Dave, probably close to a dozen papers, and almost all of them find that having an accounting expert is much more effective than having a financial expert who meets this more broad definition. So that's one thing I would encourage you to at least consider. The other thing is around independence of the audit committee. And as a result of SOX and exchange listing standards, theoretically, all audit committees are independent, and they typically are looked at in terms of family ties and economic ties. But as you well know, if I want to drive around that, there are a lot of ways to drive around that. Social ties are not really addressed. And I have a paper that I've referred to in the past with Zovana Palmrose and Terry Neal and Sue Schultz, where we look at the role of the governance committee on how people get on the board in the first place. And when the CEO is more involved in that process, any benefit of the audit committee as it relates to non-GAAP reporting that results in restatements is completely gone. It's not weakened. It's gone. And when the audit committee members get on the board with less involvement from the CEO, then non-GAAP-related restatements are significantly less likely. And we cite that in the COSO study that we just came out with. We cite that paper. And I've talked to you about that paper in the past. But so in addition to those, obviously there's a lot of other stuff out there. So I hope you and PwC and the advisory team considers all that.
Joe, they're excellent comments, and we probably need to talk offline to make sure I didn't miss some of your points here, because particularly in terms of the research that's available to us, which is important, because one of the results of Joe's recent study of looking at enforcement releases for 10 years ending 2007 was that some of the more objective, concrete kinds of attributes that typically have been focused on as part of importance in good governance from an effectiveness of the board, there was really no difference between those attributes for companies that there was no fraudulent financial reporting as compared with those companies where there was fraudulent financial reporting. You know, they were no longer discriminating. You know, in other words, both have independent directors on their audit committee, because that's now a requirement, and both have audit committee financial experts, and so to look to other kinds of variables that help discriminate what makes good governance in terms of board effectiveness and what doesn't is very important to us. And some of them, like the one that you says, who makes the appointment of who's on the board, you know, is very interesting to it. And obviously some of these are, I want to say, more softer kinds of elements that are more behavioral in nature and not as easy to measure. But Joe, I think you raise an important issue, and I think you'll be helpful to us in pointing the way to guidance that we could use in our revised framework.
Jim Doty.
Sitting here thinking about the database you have and the $75 million threshold and the fraud connection, to what extent can you find information that would help the board in directing auditors, either in audit practice alerts or in standards relating to communications with audit committees or related statements that enable us better to direct the audit profession in looking for fraud in the issuer that is a sub-$250 or sub-$75 million company? We've talked about the information that ORA is furnishing to FASB. It's the same kind of notion. Can't we get some free and reliable technical assistance here in terms of what you think, where you think the kind of gaps that Jim Cox is talking about crop up in the specific control area?
I think, again, Joe Carcello's study includes some insights that are helpful, and we have actually a separate project that tries to extend that. That's just in the early stages, but your comments are well stated and so noted, and we should try to focus on where we can make more robust the guidance in this area.
Doug Carmichael.
I have a few suggestions. I'm not suggesting that you have, but I think it's important that you not lose sight of the fact that although COSO is not a regulator, it is effectively the setter of internal control standards, and that those standards play a vital public interest role through the SOX 404 requirements. I understand why you want to have a separate discussion of financial reporting, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad idea. But I think it's very important to recognize that compliance and operational objectives very often have financial reporting implications. So I think it's important if you separate them to do extra effort to make sure that people recognize that, that compliance and operational objectives do affect financial reporting. I think an outstanding example in the current financial crisis was, New Century Financial, where they had operational control deficiencies related to not tracking their repurchase claims. And actually, they missed in their repurchase calculation a huge backlog of claims because of that operational control deficiency. The other suggestion relates to estimates. We had some discussion at a past SAG meeting about the importance of having a formal documented methodology for estimates and formal documentation of the connection between the number companies arrive at for an estimate and that documented methodology, the process. And it would be helpful for the COSO framework to cover that.
Okay. Well, with respect to the second, I hadn't focused on it. In other words, what you're saying is, as an internal control measure, you have a methodology that can be relied upon to add assurance that your judgments and estimates are reasonable.
Yeah, and formal documentation of that is necessary to really make sure that it exists. You'll hear all the time, well, we have controls, we have methodology, they're just not documented. Yeah. But that usually means they're not effective either.
Yeah. And the first point you made, we did touch upon at our advisory council meeting. And it's an important issue that we haven't, maybe Miles has solved this problem, but we haven't. It's where at 40,000 feet, I can casually say, you know, we'll split out an application from financial reporting, and don't get in more detail as to how that works. But at the advisory council meeting, that very point was made up that it's not so simple as you might think because of some of the compliance and operational material that we had that would have an effect on financial reporting. So that point was brought up in an advisory council meeting. And, you know, we have the three principles, I know, that kind of are at this point separate and how we get them to interrelate and show that the compliance and operational have implications on financial reporting is important to us. So it's a very good point. And Miles, you can add to that.
I think an important distinction here is when we talk about the two documents, the first document is the integrated framework of internal control and includes all of the objective categories. The second document we're talking about is guidance as to how you think about the application of that framework when reporting on financial or on controls over financial reporting. So we're not bifurcating the framework because that's the core document that the companies assert against and auditors attest against. We believe that needs to stay intact and consider all three categories of objectives. I think the point I'm hearing from you, Doug, is let's make sure that we emphasize the importance of the operational and compliance objectives and controls, really, when concluding on the financial reporting objective. Yeah. Thanks.
I'd like to build on that just for a second, if I can, because I think what Doug's brought out is a very important point. And I think of it in the context of the financial crisis. obviously there's three components of COSO, and we spend a lot of time talking about the internal controls of a financial reporting and 404A and 404B. But the other components, compliance, controls, and particularly I want to talk about operational controls, and I think, Doug, you've heard me say that. Dave, you heard me say this before. Lots of causes of the financial crisis, but maybe one of the greatest causes was companies, financial institutions that advertised or thought they had world-class risk management who maybe didn't understand their risks, first of all, at all, and maybe didn't or appropriately, and didn't have risk management. So there are, within COSO, operational controls over risk management. And I guess my question would be, as you think about the original framework, did you think there were deficiencies in that aspect of the operational controls over risk management that, had they been stronger, maybe companies would have had greater risk management? Or maybe because internal controls over financial reporting are subject to auditor review and reporting, whereas operational controls are not, were those operational controls like risk management subject to auditor review? Might that have a greater impact in terms of having better risk management controls being tested, so on and so forth, to either prevent the next crisis that might be coming down the pike? So maybe I can get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, just as a little background, Miles and I met very early on with Marty and Keith, and I remember you made a very similar point at that time that has really, frankly, been very influential in our mind, and that is, you know, the whole notion that one of the real opportunities we have for benefit of the refresh, the update, is in the operational area, in compliance area, too. And to not lose sight of that and not get so narrowly focused that we think all the time about financial reporting and 404, but really to think, well, are there implications from the financial crisis or otherwise that we really can provide benefits in terms of guidance in the control area that focus on compliance and operational? And your earlier comments were very influential to us. You know, for example, in the discussion at the most recent advisory council meeting where, you know, we want to not forget about compliance and operational and how that works.
Okay, we're going to go to Mary Hartman Morris, who's joining us by phone.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions, or actually a couple of statements and then questions. Again, thank you, Dave and Miles, for this. I think it's really important for investors that the COSO framework be continued and upgraded. I think that I want to echo some of the comments made by Jim, Joe, Doug, Marty, you know, the importance of, you know, from the investor's perspective on really strengthening the issues on governance and risk. And I think as a CalPERS, as a financial institutional investor, you know, we did see where there were some great concerns and some issues there. I think we're, this is more a statement than anything else about, of course, the carve-outs on the 404. I think investors lost out when, of course, that changed, although we still appreciate that management still has to make an opinion on that. My question really is, since CalPERS is becoming more global, my question is on one of the areas that I saw that was picked up was about reducing the centric preparation or perception, excuse me. I wanted to know how you're going to be doing that and how are you going to expand on that. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. Thank you.
I apologize, but the last part, U.S.-centric. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the U.S. I caught the centric part of it, but not the U.S., sorry. A very good question. We have two people on the advisory council who are their roots are outside the United States. One is through IFAC, and another is a representative from Switzerland, interestingly not. And they have already been very helpful to us in providing a perspective that we need to be sensitive to in terms of not inadvertently having the guidance written in such a manner that people outside the United States will say, well, this is, you know, American. This isn't something that's helpful to us. And you know, it doesn't extend to a desire of our part, for example, to feel obligated to fully harmonize our guidance with other models that exist outside the United States. But it is important that we present our concepts in a way that, to the extent possible, are meaningful and relevant to environments outside the United States and aren't arbitrarily discounted because of, inadvertent editing that's U.S.-centric. And that's a large part of the sensitivity that's important to us. And we do have two members of the council that are pretty aggressive in providing to us insights that help us remember that you know, we like to think that the guidance will be applicable globally. And certainly in my role on COSO, last year I made two presentations in Asia, and I'm going soon to make a presentation in Europe. And you know, I was surprised about the knowledge of COSO and you know, the importance in their view of COSO. So it's important to us. And just as another aside, you know, I mentioned the five organizations that sponsor COSO and the 500,000 members that we have. Well, a number of those members are from outside the United States, so we have a responsibility directly to our sponsoring organization stakeholders to really look outside the United States. So you know, to be sensitive to it not being U.S.-centric is maybe a little glib in terms of what that means exactly, but I assure you, we just don't want to unnecessarily make mistakes that result in our credibility suffering outside the United States. Let's put it that way.
Thank you, Dave. I just had one more thing I wanted to add to that, because I think that as we comment to other entities and even on the lessons learned, the European Union, I think we really pointed out that it was really important to maybe elevate the idea of COSO or other internal control frameworks. I think from an investor's perspective, that is one of our, you know, bases, our frameworks that we would rely on ensuring that, you know, we're understanding what is happening at the companies. So thank you.